and welcome to the Dead TV Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Chris.
And I'm your co-host, Mr. Zeneca.
And for the very first episode of the Dead TV Podcast, and for the next 7 episodes as well, with a special episode where we will go over the clans of the show with an expert on Vampire the Masquerade, we are covering Kindred the Embraced, which was a TV series created by producer Aaron Spelling, yes.
And it aired first on April 2nd, 1996.
What were you doing back in 1996, Mr. Zeneca?
Oh, 96. That was the year I graduated from high school, so it was very chaotic for me. And at the time, I actually did play the trading card game for Vampire the Masquerade, so that was actually one of the things I used to do. Now, this show I never caught live. I only caught on VHS later. But for this podcast, I actually did buy the special extended edition Kindred the Embraced with the Book of Nod included and the extended cut pilot, which we're going to be talking to. So, you know, watching it now versus watching the VHS tapes, it's really interesting because they did do a lot on quality of the show. They remastered it a little bit, I noticed. And a lot of things I just didn't remember back then watching it for the second time. So I'm really excited. This is going to be good. Now, the show, surprisingly, only had a very, very short runtime. It was from April 2nd, 1996 to May 9th. So those first 2 weeks, they kind of stuck in like 4 episodes, and then just did one a week on Wednesday nights after that. So, very, very short show, but had a massive impact on the culture, the pop culture at the time, and, you know, the people that I used to play the trading card game with, they watched it, they loved it, and it's just one of those things that, as a, you know, senior in high school, I just never got around to.
Now, the trading card game you're referring to, I think it was called Jihad?
Yes, Jihad.
Jihad, okay. Which is a game they could not make today with that title.
Yeah, no. There's way too many political stigmas with that name. But I really loved the game. You know, it was very cool. You know, I used to collect the cards, and up until about, I'd say, 2005, I actually did still have my set.
Huh.
And then I just ended up giving them away.
You know, what's funny is that I think you would have been one of those, because you were 2 years ahead of me in high school, and I was 16 when the show came out, and I was introduced to the show when I was I was introduced to the game when I was 14 years old in 1994, and like you, I saw the cards first, and then I found out there was this like whole like vampire role-playing game with all this artwork, and I was just like, oh my god, and all the time, every time I went to the gaming store, it was always like the cool goth people that were playing it and the hot goth chicks. And I was just like, I want to play this game.
Yeah,
hot girls are playing a role-playing game.
I would like to say that I was one of those cool goth chicks, but I totally wasn't. I was more very eccentric, but I wouldn't run with the goth crowd. I kind of ran with my own band of miscreants and, you know, heathens.
Cool. Well, I'll get into another story about my first time playing Vampire the Masquerade later on in another episode, as we have 8 episodes of this show to cover, so we'll have a lot of memories of our own time playing Vampire the Masquerade to talk about, as well as with an expert who will be coming on the show sometime in either December or January to talk a little bit about at least the game with us. He's not an expert on the show, but he's definitely an expert on the game, being a game master. And for everyone curious, this episode will air on iTunes and our website, RadioHorror.com, on December 1st, and then we will be recording episodes every 2 weeks, and then after Kindred, we will be going on to Constantine.
And that's going to be pretty exciting.
Yes,
I haven't
definitely
watched that one yet, so I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. And while you're at it, while you're waiting, you know, maybe ask somebody to get you some Constantine Hellblazer comic books for Christmas.
I actually do have some.
There you go.
My boyfriend's a big comic collector, and Constantine is one of his faves. So he's really excited. He hasn't seen the show either. So he's going to be watching it with me and then adding his own colorful commentary as we watch, because he's so very familiar with the comics.
A good thing for you, since you've never seen the show before, definitely watch it once and then watch it the second time to take all your notes.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. All right. So Kindred the Embraced opens up with Frank and his partner trying to track down a vampire who is being chased by two Brujas.
But they don't know if he's a vampire. They don't know anything yet.
Oh, no, they just know that he's a gangster. A gangster.
They're just thinking that it's some sort of, like, mobster action happening. And, you know, like the show opens up and the scene is set. Like, you see the Golden Gate Bridge. So we know that this takes place in San Francisco. And then one thing that the directors use throughout the series is the illusion of dawn, or the illusion of dusk, you know, because it's much harder to film during night. They use the morning hours or the nighttime hours to be kind of the buffer between, you know, the amount of sunlight needed to actually kill a vampire.
Yeah, in this show, you know, vampires can be out in daylight, which is something, by the way, a lot of people don't know. Hollywood invented the vampire cannot be in daylight. Bram Stoker wrote Dracula. Dracula was able to walk around in the daylight.
Yeah, and the first vampire in literature, Camilla, she was actually a daywalker too.
Yeah, this was a Hollywood trope that was invented. Just much like everything you know about werewolves, that was invented by Hollywood. But we're not going to get into werewolves right now. We will definitely probably cover werewolves at some point on another show.
You know, one thing that I wish would come back is that the old vampire tales all had vampires being extremely obsessive compulsive. You know, you could get away from a vampire by throwing grains of rice, or you tie knots in a bit of rope and then you throw that behind you, and the vampire would have to untie the knots or count all the grains of rice. I wish they would put that obsessive-compulsive tendency into some modern vampires. I think that would be very entertaining to watch.
I think on an episode of The X-Files, Mulder throws a bunch of sunflower seeds at a vampire, and he's like, oh, man, why did you have to do that? And the vampire gets down and starts counting them.
Yes, I remember that. That was awesome.
Oh, that was such a great episode. Oh, my God. X-Files is a whole other thing we could get into. So the Bruja killed the Gangrel, and you're right, they don't know that they don't know that they're vampires. And the Detective Frank Kohanic, I think his last name is pronounced, is played by C. Thomas Howell, and his partner is played by Eric King, who plays Sonny, who you might know as the detective also on Dexter, who was chasing Dexter around. So that actor has a long history of playing cops. This is like, he plays like three different cops on three different shows.
Well, you know, you get typecast.
He's got that cop face. He's got that bad cop face. he's like, what is that actor's name who plays Carl Winslow on Family Matters?
Oh, yeah, I know.
And
yeah,
he also
played the cop in
Die Hard.
Die Hard, yeah.
And Ghostbusters.
That's true.
And he was on an episode of Chuck playing a cop as well.
You know, you just get typecast into that role, and it's just very easy to, you know, maintain that cop attitude.
One of the things I got to point out about the Bruja when they jump off the building, when somebody jumps off a building, they jump to land, because they're superhuman, they would jump land on their feet. These guys definitely are jumping like they're trying to hit the mat.
Yes, they're falling ass down.
Yes.
Yeah, very obvious. And it begins the mystery of, you know, what's going on in the world around him, because Frank looks over the side of the building and he's expecting to see bodies or them running away or something, and there's nothing.
No.
Absolutely not. No one's there. And then he turns back to the body that was just stabbed. And, you know, very clearly he just, you know, bursts into flame, and then what turns out to be the head Gangrel actually says that, you know, he didn't say anything to anyone, you know, didn't give him anything. Now, I don't know if that phrase is actually directed at Frank himself, or he's just saying it because he's dying. That's one thing that's not really made clear as to who exactly is he talking about or who is that directed to.
the coroner, when they get the body of the coroner, believes that, you know, he's like, spontaneous combustion? Really? That's what you're going with?
Yeah. That coroner really had a stiff for the stiff. Yeah, see what I did there? Yeah. I would actually say that the way that they presented the body on the gurney was quite good. It was quite good. Considering that the body itself was engulfed in flames, then they covered it with a tarp to, you know, extinguish the fire. The body on the slab has the charred skin, but it is still rather intact. It's not like some other representations of vampires dying where it just kind of turns into dust,
uh-huh,
and you're left with a pile of ash like in like Buffy. It's actually very good, even for human physiology. The way that they represented the burned body was excellent.
Now we're meeting Julian for the first time, and Julian is played by the unfortunate the late great Mark Frankel, which from the reviews I read in Sci-Fi Magazine and old issues of TV Guide, they said was the highlight of the show. I shocked my co-host earlier today by telling her that Julian was unfortunately killed in a motorcycle accident shortly after filming the 8 episodes for this series.
Yeah.
Mark Frankel was killed in a motorcycle accident.
Yeah, because he's actually very good in this series, and he's, you know, his compassion comes through in his acting.
Yeah.
And so it's quite a significant loss of that actor, you know, because they would have to shut down the series, and that's why the series ended at the 8 episodes, which it did. But I would have really enjoyed seeing him in the season 2. But, can't do anything when life gets in the way.
And he's with his sire, the man who did turn him into a vampire years ago, after Frank's wife died in childbirth with their child, which is the reason why he kind of, very similar to Louis in Interview with the Vampire, he had pretty much given up on everything, and then Lestat found him because his wife had died in childbirth with their child, which is unfortunately something that was very common back then due to just how unclean things were at the time. Disease and infection was very common, whereas today we are a lot more careful when a woman gets pregnant. So it was easy to kill people off, and, you know, the medical reasons behind it, you can, you know, kind of research yourself on any medical history page on childbirth. But Archon Rain is his sire, played by Patrick Bekoa, whose name I'm mispronouncing, who, by the way, I was wrong, is still alive today.
Oh, good.
He's 77 good. Years old, so he's definitely up there, but he is still active in Hollywood, was in something last year, was not in anything I'm aware of 2016. But he...
hopefully 2016 won't take his life like it's taken so many others.
No. The one thing I noticed is that there's this weird thing on the entire show, and Julian does it immediately because he's all pissed about his Gangrel bodyguard getting killed off by the Bruja. His eyes glow, and that's a common thing in the show. Nobody has fangs.
The Nosferatu does. Daedalus. He's got fangs, but he's got to actually sharpen most of his teeth. So, they don't go by a lot of the standard vampire tropes in this show, and that is somewhat of a departure from the game, because in the game, and we'll kind of go over to the next scene, character here, Alexandra. Alexandra is the childer of Julian, and longtime love interest and, you know, love of his life, and she later on in the show turns into a wolf, and they do that in the series periodically, and that's, you know, one of the vampire skills. But in the game, you had to have animus in order to change into an animal.
Correct.
And the Ventru clan does not typically have animus traits, so that they do have some liberties with what is portrayed versus what's actually in the game.
And you have to learn that from a Gangrel, I believe, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's not something that's very natural.
No. You in the game, you usually basically have to rack up experience points and then go to the Gangrel clan leader and then, you know, do something for them and they'll teach you for it, and it's just usually writing it down in your little scorecard about that now that you've learned it. But in the game itself, they have you perform something for the Gangrel clan, and you have to go to your leader of whatever clan you're in to get permission to work with the Gangrel to do so. It's a whole political system.
Yeah, because the Ventru actual traits are dominate, fortitude, and presence or auspex. So those are the traits inherent to the clan itself. So to learn a trait that's outside of that, it takes a lot of experience and a lot of gameplay in order to do. And she just seems to have animus for some reason. One thing that confused me when I first watched this was that the first scene with Alexandra and Frank, you know, they're in a restaurant, very upper-class restaurant, and there's a single red rose, you know, in the vase on the table.
Correct.
Now, with Alexandra, the first scene that we see her, and when her character is introduced, she's sitting with Frank and at a restaurant, and there's a single red rose on the table. Now, the red rose is typically the symbol of the Toreador clan. So this was a little confusing. They're using symbolism from a different clan, but the red rose continues on throughout the entire episode of the pilot as a symbol for Alexandra herself. And so this is where it's established that the red rose is a symbol for her. They're in the restaurant, and he's saying how beautiful she is, but yet her hand is so cold, and she's like, oh, well, it's just very cold in here. And then he mentions how pale she is. And so she excuses herself, and she goes to the restroom, and she just so happens to find a woman doing cocaine in the restroom.
Yeah, so, I love that. She's, like, just sitting there, just like, do you mind? And she's, like, lines of cocaine everywhere, like it's the 80s.
90s. And she expresses her dominate features with this woman, and this woman willingly turns her neck to the side almost in an understanding of what it is, even though she has no concept of what she's doing. She's part of that vampire power coming out.
But she does ask Alexandra to collect, you know, she's like clearly attracted to Alexandra, and she's like, well, why don't you come closer and look at my earrings? Why don't we make out a little bit? And
yeah, Alexandra goes in for the bite.
And the actress who plays Alexandra is Kate Vernon, who, if anyone watched Battlestar Galactica, she was the fifth mysterious and final Cylon on the show. She played Ellen, the wife of Commander Ty. The big mystery Cylon.
And she's got this beautiful eyes, the blonde hair, and her character herself is just very passionate. Very passionate about Frank, passionate about how she feels with Frank, and her victim. You know, as her victim, you know, she walks out of the bathroom and sits down at the table, and she looks less pale and has more of a glow about her because she just fed. And the woman kind of stumbles out of the bathroom. Her neck is not bloodied or anything, just a tiny, tiny spot of blood on Alexandra's dress. And that is all too, you know, it's not the messy eating that is usually seen in vampire pulp culture. This is very clean. Later on in the show, you come to the understanding that a vampire's saliva heals the skin after they feed. So this woman walks out of the bathroom and stumbles, but she has no marks on her neck to, you know, indicate what she had just gone through.
The little spot of blood on Alexandra's dress, I thought maybe that was just based on their budget and that's all they could afford.
I think it was done on purpose. I think it was done on purpose. You know, Frank is a detective, you know, so he should have noticed it, but he didn't. And I think that is supposed to illustrate him kind of ignoring certain signs that he himself is changing because of her involvement, or because of his involvement with Alexandra, but because he doesn't notice all the things going on around him, it makes it that much more powerful when he actually does find out about the masquerade.
Then we move over to Alexandra's apartment. I think that, yeah, that's Alexandra's apartment because they go to the garden right outside. And they proceed to get it on, making out, and she pulls out a cocked gun out of his pants just before they have sex, which is like
a...
Yeah, but she's just like, woo, look at the size of this thing. And her reaction is...
And then in the next scene, he has the gun on his belt, and they're standing in the garden.
Yeah, but her reaction to the cocked gun...
It's one of those symbolic... locked, cocked, and ready to go type of symbols for the sexual engagement that they're about to take place.
He gets a beeper. He has his beeper go off, very 90s beeper, letting him know that Frank is leaving the, Julian, I'm sorry, I keep calling Julian by his actor's name. Julian is leaving the club, the Haven, which is owned by Lillian, the Torador vampire, Primogen, which is what they're called. The leaders of the vampire clans are called Primogens.
Primogens, yes.
And she is played by Stacey Haiduk, who is stunningly beautiful in, like, every episode that she's in.
But she's also extremely jealous, too.
Oh, yeah. And that doesn't... that comes into a little bit here. I mean, this is, like, Julian's old flame, and she's, like, the new thing in Julian's life. But this jealousy becomes more prominent in later episodes when they introduce Kelly Rutherford, which we will get into in the next episode, which we'll cover in 2 weeks, Prince of the City. Cash is hanging out with his Gangrel clan. Cash is played by Channing Rowe. Who is a character, an actor who appears in several TV series, including on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, as does the Brujah leader, Eddie. And they're all kind of hanging out on their bikes, showing like they're kind of a biker gang compared to the Brujahs, who are a bunch of businessmen, kind of tough, brawling businessmen.
Yeah, the Gangrels they showed, every time that you see a Gangrel, he's always wearing leather.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's something that the creators, the costume designers, made the choice that every time they would show a Gangrel, in order to show in costuming their animal affinity, they always have them in leather. So the Gangrels are almost like the pets of the Ventru in this show. You know, they're the enforcers and the childer of the slain Gangrel leader that we saw in the first scene becomes the protector and bodyguard of Julian, and so he basically takes the place of his sire with Julian as the prince of San Francisco. So he is right there with Julian for most of the rest of the episode. Whenever he's in a group setting, you can find him aside.
Channing Rowe plays like a badass type of character, almost like anything he's in. I mean, you just look at Cash and he's all like, yeah, I'm just going to talk like this for 8 episodes.
yeah,
the one thing I want to
point
out about Stacey, do you know what her first television show, her first acting gig ever was?
What?
She played Lana Lang on Superboy.
Really?
Yes, the 100 episodes of Superboy, which ran in syndication from 1988 to 1992, and this was before, this was a year after the final Superman movie starring Christopher Reeve, and 2 years before the launch of Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman.
Interesting. That's a good credit for her, then.
Yeah, so she got, like, she got 100 episodes, bam, right out of the way in her acting career. You know, so she started off on something pretty big in the late 80s, so... And then she's been in a ton of different things ever since, like Prison Break and True Blood and so on and so forth. Brujahs drive by, and this is something they do a lot in the show. Everything kind of slows down to show you action in a very annoying way, I think. And the Brujahs fire off this rocket launcher from a phosphorus gun, which is the only thing on this show that can kill a vampire.
And they do a drive-by style, which... honestly is very 90s to do. You know, drive-bys were you know, pretty, you know, in depth within the collective unconsciousness of America at that time. So them shooting this, like, phosphorus cannon almost of a gun out the window, basically pointed at Julian and at the gangrels, and it's this Bruja clan just coming through there. And so Frank, he sees all of this, and he sees this as a mob fight. And then he you know, goes over to him, I'm going to get you, yeah. And that's the start of where you as a viewer begin to realize Frank's deep obsession with Julian.
And he's just a cop who wants to stop crime, but he's really obsessed with Julian because he thinks Julian's like the leader of everything, which again is explored when we get into later episodes. It's heavily everyone thinks that because the reporter that's introduced as the next main character also, you know, asks Julian these types of questions. And Frank just has a really big hatred for Julian. Not really explained, other than the fact that he's a cop who's overzealous in his job. So it's definitely the pilot fixes, you know, the subsequent episodes of the show fix a lot of the crap that we hate in the pilot. Because that gets annoying really fast.
True.
In this episode,
I was almost thinking that part of the obsession was coming about because Frank had changed slightly from being with Alexandra.
Oh, yeah. But he also learns the truth, too.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. So. And he realizes there's other things going on than he realizes, so he kind of lets up on... I mean, he's always got an attitude with Julian, but he definitely lightens up a lot and is willing to work with Julian for the greater good of the city. Because he realizes Julian is not his enemy.
Yeah. And that took a little bit of time for him to come to that realization.
And also, Frank gets an amazing haircut in subsequent episodes, because his hair is horrible right now.
Yeah. The show is very dated. Like,
yeah.
You can tell this was filmed in the 90s. They have not the poppy type of fashions, but the hairstyles are definitely very 90s. The plot line holds up with time, I think, but if you were to film this in order to actually have it survive and be relevant for the times, I probably would have used a little bit more subtle clothing options.
Definitely. Next up, we have the Nosferatu clan leader, Daedalus, played by Jeff Kober, show up, which if you buy the box set that we both have, the original Vampire Saga. I love that subtitle on the top. I was like, really? Is this the original Vampire Saga? Anyway, you get a video diary with Daedalus, which we'll come back to probably at the very end, because I don't want to reveal any of the spoilers for the box set until the end of the show, which is the 8th episode. Daedalus gets a little bit more of screen time in the post world of the show, which we've both seen. He lives in Julian's basement and paints pictures, which he's kind of like this gothic artist. But he also, it's definitely, I get why he lives in the basement, because Nosferatu are kind of like sewer rat dwelling monsters.
The actual embrace to change someone into a Nosferatu clan vampire does a physical toll on the body. So the virus that is the vampire virus changes their vein structure, makes them lose their hair, changes their nails, and gives them features that are almost monstrous at times. So they tend to shun away from people because they can't really blend in like the Ventrus, like the Toreadors, or even the Tremeres. Like, they can blend in, but the Nosferatus don't have that ability, but they do have the ability of obfuscate. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But that's the ability to remain unseen. And so that is one of their key skills. And I would say that had to be brought out of necessity, because they look the way they do. And so he lives in the basement, you know, kind of a cellarish area of Julian's mansion estate.
Almost like his pet.
Yeah. And he's actually the leader of the Nosferatu clan. You know?
Yeah, he's living in the mansion basement.
And the Primogen just like living in the big house with the prince of the city.
But that's probably what he wants because he's a monster. You know, there again, Nosferatu are not ones that live in high rise apartment buildings like Lillian probably does, which I don't remember if we ever get to see Lillian's place, but I mean, her being a Torridor, she would live high above.
Yeah. And Lillian also has a full range of nightclubs. So the Haven that they had just walked out of is only one of them.
Yeah.
She's got clubs all across the West Coast, you know, that's mentioned in this episode.
Yeah, it's kind of like Lux, if you watch Lucifer, which is Lucifer's pad to, that's the nightclub that he bought when he came to Earth from Hell and
yeah.
became his home.
Yeah, and so Julian actually talks with Daedalus and about the burned body and what are they going to do. And one of the next scenes is Daedalus actually visiting the coroner at the hospital. And what's so interesting about the scene is he doesn't just walk through the door. You know, he slides himself out of one of the cold boxes, you know, that the bodies are kept in. I don't know how he got there, but he got there. And so he slides himself out, then walks up behind the coroner and orders him to use that scalpel and slice his wrists open.
One thing I want to point out about Jeff Kober really quick is he's another one of those character actors who's never really had his own thing, but he's appeared on episodes of ER, Buffy, and a couple episodes of The Walking Dead where he had his own kind of gang that Norman Reedus' character joined up with for a couple episodes, and then Rick killed him. the other thing is that he's living in Julian's wine cellar, and they both drink wine. If you remember Dracula's comment, I don't drink wine.
What?
But Julian's entire family was made their fortune in the California Gold Rush and built a wine vineyard, which he passed on to his relatives over time and kept passing on to relatives as they passed away and new relatives were born, you know, the last of his bloodline.
Well, and here's one of the confusing parts is as they're talking about wine and how wine is very heavily within this series and also within his family and fortunes made, etc., the wine vineyards of the time in the Gold Rush era, where the time that Julian was actually embraced, those were regarded to be some of the best vines, the best breeds of grapes out there. And through time, very few of these have actually survived. But the ones within the Napa Valley that have remained over 150 years still produce wine to this day. And I think, actually, I'd have to look up my facts on this, but I think some of those were actually used in the show as just a continuity of, you know, bringing the real life history of the area of Napa Valley into the show.
Now, I think this wine plotline, though, doesn't surface almost ever again through the entire show.
Yeah.
I think this is just to introduce Julian's niece.
Sasha,
who Julian's last remaining... Okay, it said Julian's last remaining relative dies, his grandson or something, his grandniece or nephew. Okay.
Grandson.
Wait a minute.
His grandson.
So if that's the last remaining blood relative, who are all the people at the funeral, and what is Sasha to him?
You know, Sasha calls the deceased man her grandfather, and we know that this person is the grandson of Julian, which would make them relatives. Now, when he explains who this person is and said that when he was alive, he had a son, and his son had children, and then this man is the oldest of those children. So this can't be his last remaining human prodigy, because this is only the senior child of his son. So all the other people in the room should also be family.
Yeah.
It's evident that they don't like Sasha because they're, like, spitting at her and you know, tutuing her. Yes, yeah, she's disrespectful. And you know, she did something a bit hot for me, but, you know, she is talking about her grandfather and how, you know, if she wasn't her it wasn't his granddaughter, that she would be going out with him, and then just lifts up the body and kisses the corpse, and to the shock and awe of everyone around.
Okay, so when she does say that, by the way, I'm reminded of something a presidential candidate just said about his own daughter. I'm not naming any names. I'm just, you can go online and look up what presidential candidate said that they would bone their own daughter.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's something else I got to point out, is that Julian, I've never seen anyone do this, and I've asked this at Vampire the Masquerade games I've played. Julian lays on the grave to hold his wife's coffin? What?
Well, I think the scene where he's talking to his deceased wife at her tombstone before he goes to the funeral, I think that is supposed to illustrate the way that ancient vampires would go to their coffins during the day.
Yeah, that's fine.
So he's like, just...
Let me lie here with you.
Yeah, and he just kind of sinks into the ground and into... I don't know why he would want to just hold a corpse, but...
No, he doesn't want to hold the corpse. He says, I want to hold the shell that holds you, which he's referring to the coffin.
I thought he was referring to the shell of the body.
You think he wants to hold the skeleton? Because she's been dead for over 100 years. She is definitely just bone.
She's either mummified, if there was a good embalming process, but it was 150 years ago, so probably not. So she's probably just bones and bits of flesh, but these are vampires. You know, death is part of their life. So I took away from it that he had melted into the actual coffin that she was in to lay with her inside her coffin with her.
Oh, okay. Now, if anyone listened to my interview with Mr. Zeneca 2 years ago, you can find an interesting fact at the very beginning of that interview about why this scene would be right up Mr. Zeneca's alley.
Yes. We won't go into that right now. We will just direct you to that.
Just direct you to that interview on the Radio Horror YouTube page and on VidMe and at the top of the Facebook page for the Dead TV podcast. moving right along, Julian's niece, played by Bridget Walsh, in this episode and in every episode she is just the yummiest thing to look at through this entire show. She is a badass biker babe, you know, with her attitude and just like her just throwing herself out there. Yes, definitely. And then, of course, her subsequent relationship with another character we will get to later on, and I think the episode entitled Romeo and Juliet. She is just so absolutely gorgeous in this show.
She's gorgeous, and she doesn't give a fuck.
No.
You know? And those are just two qualities that puts her on the badass level.
Julian tries to relate to his niece by buying her clothes, which I think this is part of the special edition. I don't remember this being on the VHS tapes. He takes his niece to a Catholic church to enroll in Catholic school, and I'm like, what is this? Again?
Yeah. It almost seems that he's trying to fit her into a square peg, square hole, and she's a round peg, and trying to conform her into fit his life.
Yeah, and then Cash shows up with his own motorcycle. Sasha thinks it's her motorcycle, and she's all like, wow. And he's like, well, I'm going to take you for a ride sometime. Julian's like...
He instantly got wet there.
Oh, yeah. any of all the comments such as that will always be made by Mr. Zeneca, because I do not have the composure nor the... unembarrassment attitude to be able to say them as convincingly as Zeneca does. And then Julian immediately says to Cash, no, that can never happen, Cash. I will rip your head from your body and find another Gangrel leader if I have to, if you touch my niece.
Yeah.
Now,
but he totally wants to. He totally does.
Yeah, why does Jillian, what type of school is that he's trying to enroll her in? Is it college? I mean, is she under 18?
I think it's a finishing school.
Okay, it's a finishing school. All right. I was really confused by that whole, because I'm like, okay, she does not look 16, 17, or 18. She clearly looks like she is in her 20s.
Yeah, I think it's a finishing school, one of those old schools, because the Tremere are very, very integrated with etiquette, protocol, ritual, and status. So I think his attempt to try to mold her into a more ladylike woman would involve her learning the rules of society. So that would be a finishing school type of...
Okay, yeah. And also the funny thing about a vampire going to a church, religious artifacts have no effect on vampires in this series.
That is true. But in the game, they did, but only if the person wielding that had an incredible amount of faith. So it's actually your faith that gives that object a power against a vampire, not the object itself.
True. Another thing about the Ventru clan on the show is that they led they have led the Kindred for 150 years, and according to the bonus material, commentary, and interviews, the previous leaders of the Kindred, at least in this area, I don't know if they're talking about all over the world, I think they might just be talking about California, the Nosferatu led the Kindred before the Ventru.
I think they were only talking about California.
Okay. Then I believe we go to Alexandra notices that she's being followed by the driver of Julian's limo.
Mm-hmm. And the generic Gangrel guy.
Oh, I thought that was the guy who was driving the limo around.
He is, but it's still a Gangrel.
Oh, it's still a Gangrel. Okay, see, I wasn't clear what clan he was. Again,
he wears leather, so he's a Gangrel.
Okay, that's right. You're absolutely right. And he's got really long hair, too. notice all the other male characters have short hair are not Gangrels. I mean, Cash does have short hair, but other Gangrels have long hair.
Yeah.
So Alexandra kicks his ass. Because
and slashes his neck.
Yeah, she's kind of a badass, you know, up to a point. Then we move on to the Torridor making the Torridor leader, Lillian, making deals with Eddie, the Bruja leader, who is our first time meeting him. And he's played by an actor who's been in multiple things, Brian Thompson, which, were you a fan of Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
I was kind of off and on with the show.
Okay. He played Lucas in the first two episodes of that show, who was like the master's kind of, sort of, pseudo buddy in very kind of weird ways before we knew how to write certain things. his vessel, but he kept saying things like, I come inside you.
Yeah.
Okay.
and when we first meet Eddie here, he's working out.
Oh, yeah. He this actor, by the way, is jacked in everything he's ever done. He was the ghoul in Fright Night Part 2, and he was jacked in that. And we'll actually have a whole episode dedicated to the Bruja clan later on in the run of this podcast.
Yeah, so he's working out, and then the Torridor leader, yeah, she talks with him about She talks with him about the power and influence that Julian has, and the influence that she needs for her clubs, and making some deals with Eddie over control of the area, etc.
Yeah, definitely. Also, I have to point out, Stacey Heideck, I'm absolutely in love with her, especially in that dress.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Definitely hot.
Oh, my God. And she's so strong. Look at her arms, too. She is jacked. I mean,
yeah,
she is.
Very, very built shoulders, you know?
Yeah.
So she can wear those strappy dresses and show off those shoulder blades and those biceps. You know, I wish I had that.
Oh my God, she is just you in your own right are absolutely beautiful compared to Stacey Heideck as well, Mr. Zeneca.
Oh well, you're being kind. But
the one line
that the Bruja leader says that kind of irked me, but I know why they had him say it, is he says, "At least I don't let my women run my businesses."
Oh, yeah, 90s,
that
90s.
Was like, yeah, so the stab in the heart there. You know, it's like, really, misogyny? But this is 96.
Okay,
so
I also missed a great line that Sasha says to the nun when the nun asks her what school she goes to. Do you remember what Sasha's reply is?
No, I don't remember that.
The Harley Davidson School of Tough Titties.
Oh, yeah. Ah, Sasha.
And then she puts the Catholic girl school outfit on, and she looks like a porn star.
Totally does. I bet, you know, if some of you out here get the extended version and see the extended cut of the pilot, you'll be wanking it to her. Guarantee it. Because she is way too hot.
Oh, my God. Yeah, she just my heart melts for the vampires on this show. I mean, vampire. I didn't spoil anything. Then we get to the Council of Vampires, which I think it's Frank's line. He calls them gangbangers with guns.
Yeah, yeah. One thing, though, that I notice is that in this Council of Vampires, there's the leader of the Toreador, Bruja, Gangrel, Ventru, Nosferatu. That's it.
Yes.
So they don't have any Tremeres, they don't have any Malkavians, they don't have really any of the more minor clans about it. It is specifically only these clans that we're going to be introduced to in the entire show.
That was probably budget.
I believe so. Like, it would get really complicated when you throw in Tremeres in there, because they are also very adversarial to the Ventru clan.
And think about it. If this show was made on HBO today, they could probably do every single clan with as many characters as they want, 10 episodes, like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, yeah. And they'd probably show the Malkavians how they should be. You know, insane maniacs.
Mm-hmm. So they all basically vote to kill Alexandra because she endangers the Masquerade, which is the first time the Masquerade word is mentioned on the show. You know, I kind of thought maybe that was breaking the fourth wall, because I could have, when we play the game, I don't recall off the top of my head if the prince, or if we do something wrong in the game, if it's, like, pointed out to us that what we're doing could endanger the Masquerade, like the way Julian puts it.
It definitely is mentioned on the player's handbook.
Okay, all right.
So you're not supposed to let the humans know that this is going on. But one thing I do wish this show had, especially in the very first opening credit type of thing, is they should have had a slide come up that explains a little bit about the Masquerade.
Oh, yeah.
You come to find out about the Masquerade, but if you did not play the game, play the card game, or any of the other materials, you might be lost with this show. And it gets better as it goes on, but this one episode, which is supposed to reel you into this world, they're throwing a lot of non-known vampire traits into the show, confusing people. Like, if you didn't know that Alexandra was a vampire, you might have mistaken her for being a werewolf.
Yeah, when she turns into the werewolf to reveal to her boyfriend that what she is, it's like, isn't he going to be confused that you're a werewolf and not a vampire? Shouldn't you turn into a bat, show the fangs,
yeah,
do something other than, like, healing the cut on his face?
And then showing him after she bites her arm and then healing all that with her saliva. But if they would have had, one slide at the very beginning, like, the Masquerade exists to protect all vampires. You must not endanger the Masquerade. And, you know, there's a world underneath what you appear. You know, something that kind of sets the stage for this. Just having the title of the show is not enough to give the audience the information necessary that shows that, okay, this is a great mistake that she has done. You know, Alexandra, they mention that since she is endangering the masquerade, that her life would be forfeit. And so they put out a blood hunt on Alexandra because she's gotten so close with Frank that she isn't, they believe that she's in danger of revealing the masquerade to him. Which is probably very true because she does later on in the episode.
Yeah. Did you also notice that she does the bleeding tears thing? I'm wondering if, now you had mentioned you haven't really watched it before, but True Blood did the bleeding tears a lot.
Yeah, I only caught a couple episodes here and there, so I didn't really get the full spectrum of the vampire traits that they had. I don't remember vampire tears ever being blood in the game. But I tried looking it up, and I couldn't find any information on that. That could be just a stylistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's a trait for a vampire that is not typically known.
The other thing I didn't quite understand is that she mentions that she has been a Tordor, she's been kindred for quite a number of years. Do you think Julian sired her?
Julian did, because it is mentioned when they talk that when he's talking to her, there is mention that she was embraced by force, you know. So there's like a rapist almost, you know, he says that he took her innocence by force. And so I was thinking, well, is that rape when you were human? Or and then I come to find out on the commentary for this episode that it was, in fact, an embrace by force. So she was embraced. They loved each other. She was embraced against her will.
Oh.
And then ended up accepting it and continuing to love Julian for it.
Now, basically, you know, the elephant in the room is that vampires are going to eat you, kill you, drink you, screw you, or turn you against your will, whether you like it or not. So vampires have always been a metaphor for rape.
Yeah.
And it gets more prevalent in another episode we will get to eventually, which will be really hitting the nail on the nose. When I first watched it, I was very kind of like, oh my god, I love the show. Oh my god, that's sad that happens. But moving on, I love the show. And then rewatching it for this podcast, I really, and being much older and wiser and so on and so forth, I've really kind of opened my eyes up to like, holy crap, they got away with that. Yeah.
As an aside, the vampires that, you know, in the mythology of Vampire the Masquerade, the vampires that are attacked, turned, and buried are called shovelheads. And so these are people that they turn into a vampire specifically with the one purpose that they are cannon fodder, that they will arise from their burial tombs and be upset and angry, and then the vampire that sired them just points them into a direction, and then they are not expected to live out more than a couple of weeks. So I don't know if Alexandra started out as a shovelhead, or it was purposely done by Julian to make it so that she couldn't leave him.
True. The death of Alexandra reminds me of two things. One, did you ever watch Sons of Anarchy?
No, I have not watched that show.
Okay, I don't want to give it away, but there's the finale of the entire show involves the death of a major character, and it's basically kind of like suicide, but it's forced. It's like forced suicide. Very much like Alexandra, she has to give herself up. She knows it, so she doesn't fight it for very much. She kind of runs a little bit, and the fact that the Gangrel can't find her is a little odd, considering that they're all about being trackers, but they can't find Alexandra.
Yeah. So the blood hunt is on, and she's running away.
Yeah, and then
she's kind of ducking in corners, and the Gangrels can't find her, and the only person that does is Daedalus. Knows exactly where to find her, pulls up in a taxi.
Yeah.
And she knows she's screwed as soon as she sees talony fingernails.
Which, by the way, for you millennials, a taxi is what we called Uber back then. We're really old in our 30s, by the way, so just let you know.
Oh, don't be condescending.
By the way, her death reminds me of Claudia's dying from an Interview with the Vampire.
A little bit. But one of the things that is very interesting is that Frank had mentioned that his wife had died by suicide, and Alexandra is dumped right near the Golden Gate Bridge, and Daedalus says that may the water be your salvation. So Daedalus is putting her in a situation to basically jump off the bridge.
Yeah.
Or jump off an adjoining area next to the bridge. Frank gets this call from a disguised voice that has been kind of cluing him in on what's going on in order to find her.
Only episode that the voice box thing is ever used. They completely drop it after the pilot.
Oh, because we, as audiences, know who the voice is by the end of the episode.
True, but Frank never learns who his contact is until, like, I guess ever. He kind of never figures it out, even though in the last episode he does learn something. But it's never becomes a thing anymore for even Frank's eyes. I mean, yeah, we as the audience know, but for Frank, it's just something they just don't write anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, since this is very close to the end of the episode, we have Frank that is running to the rescue of Alexandra, and she is standing on the edge of the bridge, and she's about to jump off because the sun is rising, and you know, she bursts into flame, and so he has to relive this suicide again with the new woman that he loves. And it's even more powerful because he has that affinity from having sex with her. He himself has been changed a bit. So it's even harder now on him than it was with his first wife.
Mm-hmm.
The person that is calling him to give this information, for one, has to be connected to Julian, because Nosferatu is, you know, Daedalus is doing it for Julian. So he would have to relay where he's dumping her off in order for that person to call and inform Frank.
And
so there's some intrigue going on with this.
And they're also trying to, if you remember earlier in the episode, they point out that they know that there's a traitor in their midst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're trying to track down the traitor as well. So Frank is basically being tortured with the death of Alexandra. You know, that's the only reason why you would call him and have him appear at the place where she's going to, in essence, you know, kill herself, jump into the river, etc. So he's being tortured. The Venture has been watching him, you know, as evidenced by the Gangrel kind of hanging around. And so the Venture has been watching him. Nosferatu's being the enforcer, and someone is physically torturing Frank with this. Physically torturing this detective for his connection to her. We learn at the end of the episode that the person that is this traitor and the person that's been calling him and is in essence torturing him is his actual partner, his cop partner.
Sonny.
Who turns out to also be a vampire.
Yes.
And turns out to be a Ventru vampire sired by Julian.
With the very, very unusual, when he's sitting there laughing, you know, like, and his eyes roll back into his head, and he shows his mouth full of teeth all normal. And Eddie's just sitting there watching him do it. I just think that's really bad script writing on someone's part.
This script could have definitely used a few more touches for clarity.
Yeah.
Because we have Sunny, who is revealed to be a Venture because Julian is a sire, sitting with the leader of the Bruja clan, conspiring and making deals, saying, Eddie's saying, well, when I'm Prince of the City, you can have anything you want. And then Sunny just, like, laughing and like, ha ha ha. We don't really know what he wants at that point in time, but he has this joy that he's torturing his friend, basically conspiring against his sire, and in the vampire world, doing that, Eddie would have to have a moral obligation to kill Sunny once he actually rose to power because he is not trustable. So it makes a very interesting situation because Eddie is promising him everything, and then when he does get into power, he has the obligation to actually kill Sunny for being a traitor.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm going to point out about this podcast that will happen a lot on the show is that me being a filmmaker and having studied film a lot, I'm going to be a lot more nitpicky about certain things like the scene, the exchange between Eddie and Sunny. It's just kind of unnecessary and could have just been completely cut out. As soon as we found out Eddie was working with Eddie, that was it. They could have cut right to Alexandra's apartment, which is the next scene that we go to. Always know that I love every show that we're going to be reviewing, but as a filmmaker, I'm definitely going to be pointing out some of the just, like, irritating stuff that they could have cut out of certain scenes, especially with shows like this that are not 100% universally loved. Mr. Zeneca will be a little bit more on the positive side than me.
And I could see how, because when this was aired, it was aired on April 2nd, which was a Tuesday, and then the next day they had the following episode.
The I think it's called the Prince of the City.
Prince of the City.
Let me break out the Prince of the City is the next episode. Yes, and you're correct. 4/2/96, 4/3/96 following.
Yes. So they were trying to hook people on this concept, the characters, everything else. If I were to only see this episode, I'm not sure I would have been hooked.
No.
And maybe that's why they planned 4 episodes within that first 2 weeks of run.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This first episode, I mean, I think a lot of people, I know a lot of people who said, I've talked to, said, oh, I saw that first episode, and I was like, that was garbage. I mean, everyone can't act. The plot line was terrible. I hated the cinematography at times. I hated some of the scenes. And just a lot of, like, really just dislike of the show because they only watched the pilot. Now, I have always said, you gotta watch a couple more episodes. It's a canceled show, but that show really began to pick up, and it was and everything changed by the second episode. It was, the pilot was like the test episode that they just went with to get it on the air, I think. I mean, obviously that's probably Aaron Spelling's decision because it's Spelling Television is the producers of the show. And Aaron Spelling ruled the 90s. I mean, you had 90210 and Melrose Place and Models, Inc.
Wasn't he involved with Buffy as well?
No, Buffy was not his show. Buffy was all Joss Whedon on the CW.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I believe he was involved in other shows, on top of his daughter being as popular as she was, Tori Spelling.
Tori, yeah.
Yeah, which, by the way, Tori Spelling was in a vampire movie over the summer, which was a remake of a vampire movie, of a serial killer movie she was in 20 years ago, where she was the daughter, and in the vampire movie, she plays the mother. It's called Mother May I Sleep with Danger, and it's a lesbian vampire romance produced by James Franco.
Really?
Yes.
James Franco?
In the original, Tori Spelling is dating a guy who her mother finds out is a serial killer, and she wants her daughter to stop seeing because she believes that this guy has killed other women. In the remake for 2016, James Franco wrote and produced this movie. It's him and Tori Spelling sitting in a pool of blood with their eyes above the pool on the cover for the poster. Tori Spelling finds out that her daughter, who never dates, brings home a girl, finds out that her daughter is a lesbian, can't deal with that, but not only that, finds out that her daughter's lesbian lover is also, in fact, a vampire, and this vampire clan wants to basically kill her.
Sounds like gold.
And James Franco is in the movie as a producer for the college play Hamlet. No, not Hamlet. Not Othello. Not The Taming of the Shrew. Shoot.
Othello?
What's the what's the Shakespearean play that Oh Brother Where Art Thou is based on?
Oh. I have no idea what Oh Brother Where Art Thou is based on.
Oh man. Okay. So whatever the Shakespearean play that they're doing in this is, they cast her in the daughter as the lead, which has typically always been a male lead. So she's interacting with other females like the male would, very touching, very kind of lesbian, you know, heavy kissing and so on and so forth, which just kind of drove the nail home a little too hard that they were making this a very openly minded kind of gay romantic drama. I wouldn't say it's a comedy. The scenes Franco's in are very comedic, but everything else about this movie was garbage.
So, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you rate that movie?
I would rate this movie as being really drunk to watch it.
So it's like a 2, but a drunk 3.5?
Yes.
Okay.
It's just so incredibly tasteless, but I couldn't stop watching it, having watched the original 20 years ago, which had nothing to do with vampires or lesbians. It was a straight-up drama for Lifetime.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
Well, let's get back to vampires here. We're almost done with this episode.
Yeah, so Frank confronts Julian at Alexander's apartment. And right there, I need to point out that thank God they gave C. Thomas Howell some acting lessons on how to shoot a gun, because he holds a gun in the most ridiculous way. Like, on this sideways glance, he constantly is holding a gun. You know, he doesn't hold a gun like a real cop would, even a cop in anger.
No, because a real cop would use both hands, and the sights would be lined up for where he's wanting to shoot.
Yeah.
So you could totally tell that Julian had the squibs on him, because the gun had nowhere near the aim that would be necessary to make those shots.
Yeah. He shoots Julian, and that begins their bromance.
he shoots him like, my heart's beating, yours is not, shoot, shoot, shoot. And then Julian gets back up and talks to him and like, well, she gave her life for yours. I don't want my life. Shoot, shoot, shoot. And then Julian gets back up and ends up giving him this locket and walks out.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, honestly, this shooting of, first of all, by the way, Julian never gets back at Frank for shooting him like twice or three times.
Yeah.
And it's never mentioned again. It's never mentioned that this is how they start the relationship. The death of Alexandra is brought up again a couple more times. But this whole, you know, it's definitely like they took the pilot script and ignored a lot of the stuff they realized didn't test well, thankfully, and carried over the things that were the basis for the show. The characters, the power struggle with Eddie and Julian, and Frank's, like, hatred of Julian, and Sonny, and everything. Basically, all the prime elements that we care about got carried over, and things that we don't care about, or things that were kind of like, why did they do that, were never brought up again.
Yeah. One point on the locket. Now, the locket Alexandra gives to Julian when they meet up and after the blood hunt has been declared and she says her goodbyes pretty much to Julian, she gives him this locket, and in the locket is a picture of a rose. Now, when Frank opens the locket, he sees an image of Alexandra kind of spinning around dancing in her rose garden. One of the things that is brought up on the commentary is that this type of vampiric power, which is to see an impression of the last owner of an object, it's supposed to give the audience this indication that Frank himself has changed enough to this point that he's able to have this vampire power. It's very interesting. I'm not sure if it totally came through, because I saw it and I only thought it was maybe a memory of her that he's projecting onto this locket, not specifically a vampire power. I didn't catch that the first time I watched it. But this locket has the rose image on it, and it's supposed to represent her. And I thought it was just a very interesting vampire power that they tried to give Frank and then ends up not doing anything later on in the series. But
yeah, completely dropped. The only thing I think besides, I mean, the second in the Prince of the City, it's the fallout of Alexander's death and so on and so forth. We'll get to more detail about that. I don't think either one of us mentioned, Frank drinks Alexander's blood. Not like in the way we would drink a cup of wine, or like if I bit down into a victim and drank her blood. But he licks her blood, so he has enough for her blood in him that he starts feeling something. And then Tordor leader brings it up to Frank in a very sexual way. He's like, I heard you tasted Alexander's blood. You have to tell me about that sometime, Frank.
Yeah. Yeah, and this was done right after she revealed the masquerade to him and, you know, cuts her own arm and then heals her own arm with her saliva and tells him all about this, and he is sickened. And yet, after he is, like, morally and ethically sickened by what he's just heard and seen, she, you know, holds out her arm and says, you know, taste it. And he does, which I would be very weirded out about, because I just found out that this person is a vampire and now they're asking me to drink their blood. You know, and he only had a slight taste of it, but it was enough to give me pause as for why the hell are you doing this as a detective? And I know you love this woman, but you just found out she's a vampire. And by all accounts, they know what vampire lore is, and that the vampirism is transmitted through the blood. So, I have no idea why this detective would even drink the blood, but he did, and he got a stomach ache, and she explains, oh, you're sick because you drank my blood.
Usually, by the way, when a human drinks a vampire's blood, it makes them feel empowered, or if they're sick, it heals them, or heals a wound, usually. It doesn't just make them sick automatically. Vampire blood for humans in most other iterations are usually, it's like a drug, and it gives them a bit of a boost in something, depending on what it may be for the plot line of whatever the writers are doing, but it doesn't ever make them sick, so I thought that was kind of strange. But maybe Frank is like me. I'm also into strange and unusual women, and if a woman did that to me, I would be like, oh, well, I mean, we've already slept together, so fluids are fluids, right?
true. But I just thought that as a detective, he would not really want to drink the blood.
True. Did you do you notice the cast photo, by the way, in the box set? When you open the box set for the first time, you get the typical cast photo, that the wine glass next to Julian on the table is spilt over, and it looks more like blood spilling on the floor than wine.
Yes.
And Lydia has a wine glass, and Channing Rowe's character, Cash, has a wine glass. Not that that's really relevant, but I thought Julian's spilt over was interesting.
Yeah, because that's supposed to be, I believe, a symbol of the spilt blood that is done in his name.
Correct. I also wonder why Eddie isn't in the cast photo, and he's only in 5 episodes, but honestly, he's only in 2 episodes less than any of the other characters that are on the show that aren't in every single episode.
Well, maybe he couldn't make the cast photo that day.
Hmm. I always thought that was strange. Every time there was an Eddie episode, or an episode that Eddie was in, it would always, like, he wasn't getting the top billing. So maybe, this show was taking place in 1996. It was filmed in 1995, so he might have been busy doing the X-Files, because he was playing the alien bounty hunter on the X-Files.
That's true.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot of character acting.
Correct. And then one of the biggest highlights, I think, for him on any other show is he returned to Buffy and he played the judge. It was a godlike monster who couldn't be killed by any weapon forged. And Buffy gets a bazooka and he's like, no weapon forged can destroy me. That was then. This is now. And he's like, what does that do? but that actor is fantastic in, like, anything that he happens to be in. Like, Dr. Mordred, which was a great movie from the 80s starring Jeffrey... from the early 90s starring Jeffrey Combs.
Sweet.
So, that was the pilot episode of Kindred the Embraced. Mm-hmm. Initial thoughts? Boy, did the show get better after this.
Yes, yes. And I think this is also, you know, starting that bromance between...
Love
Frank
that word.
Julian. But also this begins that old adage that keeping a promise to someone is going to ruin you in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be the whole promise of the show, is like keeping your promises is going to be your downfall.
Correct. Absolutely. Well, that is pretty much it for this episode of the Dead TV Podcast. We will return in 2 weeks for The Prince of the City, and then that will be recorded and then air on our iTunes page and the main broadcasting website, which is RadioHorror.com. But you can go to iTunes as well and look up the Dead TV Podcast. I was very excited today to find out we are finally on iTunes.
Yay!
That's where you got to be. You got to be on iTunes, because most people use an Apple device to download stuff to listen to at the gym or so on and so forth.
Yep.
So when this episode airs, please leave a rating, leave a comment, because that's how it helps us. And then over on the Radio Horror page, if you would like to help the Dead TV Podcast in any of its endeavors or anything that we may be doing or equipment, there is a Patreon link that will go up on RadioHorror.com to help the Dead TV Podcast.
Excellent. Well, it was great actually talking with you today, Dr. Chris, and I look forward to continuing the series with you.
Yes, absolutely. You as well, Mr. Zeneca. And you can also find us on Facebook at the Dead TV Podcast, as well as Radio of Horror. And Mr. Zeneca, do you have a Facebook page for your endeavors?
I do. So on Facebook, just look up Mistress Zeneca, and you can find my page there. Or you can go to my website, elegantlykinky.com.
Where you can find out about all of the strange, unusual, and kinky things that are happening in Pennsylvania.
Yes, yeah. Some of which I produce.
Coincidence that we're doing a vampire show and you're in Pennsylvania. I'm only reminded of that from an episode of The Simpsons where Homer, it's the Bram Stoker's vampire parody episode of The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, and Homer turns around and looks at his family and goes, we're going to
Pennsylvania.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining me for the premiere episode of the Dead TV Podcast and the first episode of Kindred the Embraced.